the high tide line. More than 30% of the populations of Egypt, Thailand, Malaysia, the Philippines, Japan, Myanmar would also suffer that fate in a scenario where the temperature rises by more than 4 degrees Celsius. Climate Central has also stressed visual illustrations of how prominent American landmarks will look after sea level rises. Almost all of the land around the Statue of Liberty National Monument will be submerged, as will the area surrounding Space Center Houston. Yet these and other major landmarks would almost certainly have to be abandoned long before sea levels rose that high, as there will be an increase in heavy rainfalls and storm surges.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Abdulbari Atwan, a well-known author, has described the recent highlights in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon as an American Zionist conspiracy to ignite a civil war in the region. Atwan stated that the U.S. Zionist conspiracy to create a sectarian conflict in the region will fail. He said, sectarian conflicts have been created with the aim of securing Israel's interests and stealing Lebanese gas. But this sedition will not go ahead, and if it goes on, the U.S. and its allies will surely be defeated. In fact, the axis of resistance in the region has so far managed to oppose Western, namely United States and Israel, interests in the region and foiled their plots. Members of the axis of resistance include Iran, Syria, and Lebanon's Hezbollah, and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas, to name a few. The U.S. has attempted to weaken the resistance axis by hatching different plots, such as causing instability and wars in the region for years. However, the resistance has always been ready to properly respond to these threats. For instance, Washington has always sought to keep Israel's enemies at one another's throat so that they could not give Israel trouble. But the resistance front has time and again proven that it will not allow the Tel Aviv regime to commit crimes with impunity, as it has launched retaliatory attacks against Tel Aviv, which have exposed the vulnerability of the regime's entities in the region. Israel's constant violations of Lebanese airspace are also a source of instability. This has been seen as a constant provocation by Israel, mainly directed at the resistance movement Hezbollah. Meanwhile, the U.S. has also been accused of creating an atmosphere of instability. On the one hand, it has imposed sanctions on Lebanon, which prevents foreign investment in the country. It has even opposed the delivery of fuel shipments from Iran, is in an emergency mode due to a lack of fuel. Meanwhile, the U.S. ambassador has stirred controversy by making anti-Hezbollah statements, so much so that a judge ordered a media ban on her. The trip by the number 3 diplomat at the State Department, Victoria Nolan, to Lebanon, also proved to be controversial. Her purpose was to meet government officials and representatives to discuss Lebanon's reforms and elections. The question that arises is, what does she have to do with Lebanon's elections? Nolan was famously accused of promoting regime change in Ukraine, backing the Maidan protesters and opposition, which showed how the Ukrainian opposition is being manipulated by Washington. Coincidentally, while she was there, the deadly protest in Lebanon erupted, which resulted in the death of several Lebanese. What is for certain is that the popularity of the resistance in the region will be a severe challenge for the enemies, who are hatching plots against them, specifically Israel and the US. The face-off between the Venezuelan government of Nicolas Maduro and the opposition led by Juan Guaido has put Caracas in a years-long political impasse and economic crisis. Several rounds of talks in recent years have been futile, and the two sides have failed to reach a consensus. In August, the Venezuelan government and the opposition began a new round of negotiations in Mexico City aimed at overcoming Venezuela's political and economic crisis. The dialogue was mediated by Norway. However, the latest developments have hampered the process of a possible settlement. Venezuela's government has decided to suspend the talks after Cape Verde extradited a Venezuelan envoy named Alex Saab to the United States on money laundering charges on Saturday. Saab was arrested in Cape Verde under a U.S. arrest warrant in June 2020 when his plane stopped there to refuel. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro lashed out at the U.S. for what he called kidnapping of an envoy to face an American court.
Saab was taken yesterday, skirting over everything. A plane arrived, assassins, hitmen came down. They sought him out and they removed him with blows from the jail he was held. They took him without advising lawyers, the family, nobody. A kidnapping by the United States government of an international diplomat.
Jorge Rodriguez, who heads the government's negotiating team, described the government's decision as a deep expression of protest over the brutal aggression against Alex Saab. He also called on Washington to release Saab immediately.
Venezuela is alerting the world that the life of Alex Saab is in danger. It's in the hands of judicial system that is directed at harming Venezuela. And we demand his immediate release by the American government.
The U.S. charged Saab in 2019 in connection with a bribery scheme and sanctioned him for allegedly orchestrating a corruption network that allowed Caracas to profit from a state-run food subsidy program. However, Saab's lawyers have denied the U.S. charges as politically motivated.
This is absolutely a political attack on Venezuela, and it is a kidnapping. This shows just how far in lawlessness the United States is willing to go and how much they are determined to attack Venezuela.
Meanwhile, U.S.-backed opposition figure Juan Guaido reacted to the decision to suspend the talks, accusing the government of evading the nation's problems. Caracas aims to ease U.S.-led sanctions on the Venezuelan nation, while the opposition says it aims to use the talks to secure guarantees for regional elections to be held in the fall. Venezuela descended into political turmoil after U.S.-backed opposition figure Juan Guaido unilaterally declared himself as the interim president in January 2019. He claimed that Maduro's re-election in 2018 was fraudulent. Then, United States refrained from recognizing Nicolas Maduro's re-election in 2018, imposed sanctions on the crisis-hit economy of the Latin American nation, and froze millions of dollars of Venezuelan money in the U.S. bank account. Washington has been using sanctions as leverage to overthrow the legitimate government of Maduro in what has been termed economic terrorism. Venezuela has faced chronic shortages of food and medicine as a result of U.S. sanctions, resulting in years of political and economic crisis.
Well, this is exactly what the U.S. government wants to prevent. And this may be also an effort on their part to sabotage even the negotiations going on in Mexico. That how can the talks continue under in this situation? But What needs to be condemned and denounced is depriving any country of food and medicine, particularly in this time of pandemic.
while freezing assets and slapping illegal sanctions on countries that refuse to submit to Washington's hegemonic policies is nothing new. The U.S. sanctions have directly targeted Venezuelan people. Experts say the sanctions, used as a tool for regime change, have no effect on the stability of Maduro administration, but further complicate the socioeconomic condition of ordinary people amidst a full-blown crisis. Seven people were killed and 60 others injured after a peaceful protest in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, turned deadly on Thursday. It all began as heavy gunfire erupted during a rally of Hezbollah and Amal movement supporters to protest against a judge probing the last year's Beirut port explosion as they accuse him of political bias and being swayed by the U.S. Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah has accused Judge Tarek Bitar of politically targeting officials in his investigation. The Beirut port blast in August 2020 killed over 200 people, injured around 6,000, and left some 300,000 homeless. It also caused further damage to Lebanon's already fragile economy. Following the unrest, Hezbollah and the Amal movement in a joint statement said the attack was aimed at creating civil strife. Hezbollah initially blamed the attack on the Christian Lebanese Forces Party, led by Samir Jaja. Later, reports from Lebanon's Interior Ministry confirmed that the far-right Lebanese Forces Party had started the Thursday shooting in Beirut. Hezbollah accused the Lebanese Forces Political Party of taking orders from the United States and being financed by some Arab countries. The Lebanese president vowed to hold accountable the perpetrators.
What happened will be the subject of security and judicial follow-up, and I, for my part, will ensure that the investigation reaches the truth of what happened in order to hold those responsible and instigators to account.
Aoun described the incident as painful and unacceptable. So far, Lebanese authorities have arrested 19 people in connection with the violence.
Well, the uproar and instability and confusion in the region are directly attributable to the United States, to the apartheid entity of Israel, and to the repressive and repulsive monarchy of Saudi Arabia. So the whole issue is basically outsiders doing their best to destabilize the region.
Israel has once again taken advantage of civilian aircraft covers to conduct airstrikes on Syria, a potentially dangerous move that could have resulted in an enormous tragedy. Israeli warplanes carried out strikes on the Palmyra area in the eastern countryside of Syria's Homs province. A Syrian soldier was killed and three others wounded in the attack.
They can commit crimes with impunity and feel that they have enough political cover because of their influence on the governments of the world, and which consequently influence the United Nations. They're backed by the United States, and their influence over the U.S. government and U.S. foreign policy is tremendous. They have more influence over U.S. foreign policy than U.S. citizens do.
A top Russian commander said in a statement that Syria decided not to use its air defense system to counter the Israeli attack, as two passenger airliners were flying in the area at the time. Israel has repeatedly used civilian aircraft as a shield against Syrian air defense systems in its aggression against the Arab country. In February 2020, an Airbus A320 with 172 passengers on board was forced to make an emergency landing at the Russian-operated Hamamim Air Base during an Israeli attack. Back in 2018, Israel had to apologize for using a Russian reconnaissance aircraft as a shield during an attack, causing a Syrian S-200 surface-to-air missile to shoot down the Russian aircraft instead and kill 15 Russian and 2 Syrian service members. Iran's ambassador to the Vienna-based international organizations has criticized the International Atomic Energy Agency for its lenient approach toward Israel's nuclear program. Kazem Gharibabadi said silence and negligence toward the issue send negative signals to the members of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. He expressed regret that the agency considers being outside the treaty as being exempt from any commitment and criticisms. He was responding to comments IAEA Chief Rafael Grossi made in an interview. When asked about the agency's focus on Iran's nuclear program and silence about that of Israel, Grossi argued that Tehran is a member of the NPT and must subject its nuclear sites to inspections and verifications, while the Israeli regime hasn't even signed the treaty.
Well, the UN does not condemn Israel because Israel has been very effective with their foreign policy and their intelligence operations, infiltrating every other government on the planet. It's because of this that Israel can influence these governments to not take action against them either directly or via the United Nations, and that's why Israel gets away with this with no consequences.
Israel, which pursues a policy of deliberate ambiguity about its nuclear weapons, is estimated to have hundreds of nuclear warheads in its arsenal. The regime has refused to allow inspections of its military nuclear facilities or sign the NPT. The Israeli regime, which is West Asia's only possessor of nuclear arms, has so far assassinated 7 Iranian nuclear scientists. But Iran's calls on the international community to hold the regime responsible for its crimes have fallen on deaf ears. Iran says the silence will embolden the regime to expand its aggressive measures. On October 19, 2014, Press TV lost one of its hardest-working correspondents, Serena Shim. She did her final report on heavy clashes in the Syrian city of Kobani between Daesh terrorists and local Kurds. Serena and her camerawoman were returning to their hotel when a truck crashed into their car. The camerawoman sustained severe injuries but survived the incident. Luck, however, wasn't on Serena's side. Accounts of Serena's death, who was transferred to a different hospital, vary. Early reports suggested that she had lost her life at the scene of the crash. This is why later accounts said that she had passed away due to heart failure after being transferred to the hospital nearly 30 minutes later. Turkish authorities blamed the incident on the camerawoman who had been behind the wheel at the time of the incident. There were no follow-up investigations by authorities in Ankara. Serena's death came only 2 days after she told Press TV that Turkish intelligence had accused her of espionage for the country's opposition parties.
I'm very surprised at this accusation. I've even thought of actually approaching Turkish intelligence, and because I have nothing to hide and I've never done anything aside from my job, and I'd like to make that apparent to them.
Serena's colleagues say she had told them a day before her death that she had with her documents that would implicate Turkey's role in the rise of Daesh and other terrorists in Syria.
Serena herself gave us a heads up just less than 24 hours before she was apparently killed on the road back home when she was leaving the area where she was reporting at and coming back to her family and to her children, while having with her evidence that implicates international agencies like the WHO for aiding and abetting terrorist organizations that were wreaking havoc inside of Syria, apparently with the help of certain Turkish factions or certain Turkish security authorities. We still don't know the entire truth.
7 years following her unfortunate death, no further information has been released regarding the fatal accident. Serena started working for Press TV in 2007. She did reports in different countries, including Lebanon, Iraq, Ukraine, and Turkey.
Serena Shim, Press TV, Donetsk, Eastern Ukraine. Serena Shim, Press TV, Tripoli. Serena Shim, Press TV, Istanbul.
She was a U.S. citizen of Lebanese origin. The U.S. State Department, however, rejected her family's call to probe her death, saying it, quote, does not conduct investigations into deaths overseas. 2 days before her fatal accident, Serena had said on live TV that she had been targeted for her investigative reports regarding Ankara's direct support for terrorist groups whose evidence had been largely concealed at the time.
I am a bit frightened about what they might use against me. We were some of the first people on the ground, if not the first people, to get that story of those Tafiri militants going in through the Turkish border from the Beb el Hawa Rihanli border, being sent in. I got images of them in World Food Organization trucks. It was very apparent that they were Tafiri militants by their beards and by the clothes that they wore, and they were going in there with NGO trucks.
Syria has been gripped by foreign-backed militancy since March 2011. The Syrian government says the U.S. and its allies are aiding Tafiri terrorist groups that are wreaking havoc in the Arab country.
Syria 2010 has nothing to do with Syria 2011 that saw a war waged by the international community with the help of Turkey and with the lead of the United States of America. It's not that we should hold them responsible. They are the reason for the havoc that was wreaked inside of Syria. They are the reason and the main instigators and founding fathers of ISIS and Daesh and Al-Qaeda, which we never knew in our regions before the U.S. occupation landed in our region.
7 years on, questions into the circumstances of Serena's death remain unanswered. Her mother said in an interview that Serena paid the price of telling the truth. The 29-year-old mother of two was laid to rest in a cemetery near the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Press TV remembers her as a brave correspondent with an unwavering dedication to her career.
In the limelight.
A nurse testified before a Georgia Senate study committee in September that she was attacked by a patient so severely last spring she landed in the ER of her own hospital. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Bram Sable Smith and Andy Miller researchers. This article is published under the heading U.S. Hospital Workers Report Rising Violence Throughout Pandemic. Stay tuned for more. In the earliest days of the pandemic, nightly celebrations lauded the bravery of frontline healthcare workers. 18 months later, those same workers say they are experiencing an alarming rise in violence in the workplaces. A nurse testified before a Georgia Senate study committee in September that she was attacked by a patient so severely last spring she landed in the ER of her own hospital. At Research Medical Center in Kansas City, Missouri, security was called to the COVID unit, said nurse Jen Caldwell, when a visitor aggressively yelled at their nursing staff about the condition of his wife, who was a patient. In Missouri, a tripling of physical assaults against nurses prompted Cox Medical Center Branson to issue panic buttons that can be worn on employees' identification badges. Hospital executives were already attuned to workplace violence before the pandemic struck, but the stresses from COVID have exacerbated the problem, they say, prompting increased security, de-escalation training, and pleas for civility. And while many hospitals work to address the issue on their own, nurses and other workers are pushing federal legislation to create enforceable standards nationwide. Paul Sarnes, an executive at Virtua Health in New Jersey and president of the International Association for Healthcare Security and Safety, said many studies show healthcare workers are much more likely to be victims of aggravated assault than workers in many other industries. Federal data shows health workers faced 73% of all non-fatal injuries from workplace violence in the U.S. in 2018. It's too early to have comprehensive stats from the pandemic. Even so, Michelle Wallace, chief nursing officer at Grady Health System in Georgia, said the violence is likely even higher because many victims of patient assaults don't report them. We say this is part of our job, said Wallace, who advocates for more reporting. Caldwell said she had been a nurse for less than 3 months the first time she was assaulted at work. A patient spit at her. In the 4 years since, she estimated she hasn't gone more than 3 months without being verbally or physically assaulted. Caldwell said, I wouldn't say that it's expected, but it is accepted. We have a lot of people with mental health issues that come through our doors. Jackie Gatz, Vice President of Safety and Preparedness for the Missouri Hospital Association, said a lack of behavioral health resources can spur violence as patients seek treatment for mental health issues and substance use disorders in ERs. Life can also spill inside to the hospital, with violent episodes that began outside continuing inside or the presence of law enforcement officers escalating tensions. A February 2021 report from National Nurses United, a union in which both Camara and Caldwell are representatives, offers another possible factor. Staffing levels that don't allow workers sufficient time to recognize and de-escalate possibly volatile situations. COVID unit nurses also have shouldered extra responsibilities during the pandemic. Duties such as feeding patients, drawing blood, and cleaning rooms would typically be conducted by other hospital staffers, but nurses have pitched in one of those jobs to minimize the numbers of workers visiting the negative pressure rooms where COVID patients are treated. While the workload has increased, the number of patients each nurse oversees is unchanged, leaving little time to hear the concerns of visitors scared for the well-being of their loved ones, like the man who aggressively yelled at the nurses in Caldwell's unit. In September, 31% of hospital nurses surveyed by that union said they had faced workplace violence, up from 22% in March. Dr. Brice Garland, Hospital Group President of Atlanta-based Emory Healthcare, said violence has escalated as the pandemic has worn on, particularly during the latest wave of infections, hospitalizations, and deaths. Garland said frontline healthcare workers and first responders have been on the battlefield for 18 months. They are exhausted. Like the increase in violence on airplanes, at sports arenas, and school board meetings, the rising tensions inside hospitals could be a reflection of the mounting tensions outside them. William Mahoney, president of Cox Medical Center Branson, said national political anger is acted out locally, especially when staffers ask people who come into the hospital to put on a mask. Caldwell, the nurse in Kansas City, said the physical nature of COVID infections can contribute to an increase in violence. Patients in the COVID unit often have dangerously low oxygen levels. People have different political views. They are either CNN or Fox News, and they start yelling at you, screaming at you, Mahoney said. When that happens, they become confused and also extremely combative, Caldwell said. Sarnacy said the pandemic has given hospitals an opportunity to revisit their safety protocols. Limiting entry points to enable COVID screening, for example, allows hospitals to funnel visitors past security cameras. Research Medical Center recently hired additional security officers and provided de-escalation training to supplement its video surveillance, spokesperson Christine Hamel said. In Branson, Mahoney's hospital has bolstered its security staff, mounted cameras around the facility, brought in dogs. People don't really want to swing at you when there is a German Shepherd sitting there, and conducted de-escalation training in addition to the panic buttons. Some of those efforts predate the pandemic, but the COVID-19 crisis has added urgency to an industry already struggling to recruit employees and maintain adequate staffing levels. The number one question we started getting asked is, "Are you going to keep me safe?" Mahoney said.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Source of Evils. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Many books and articles have been written in respect of the harmful effects of wine, including fatal effects on the nervous and digestive systems and the heart, arteries, liver, kidneys, and other organs of the body. Drinking wine, consuming alcohol, not only brings about the destruction of the hereafter, it is also detrimental for every single one of its consumers in this world. We know the physical impact that the alcoholic beverages has on its consumers. Its painful social and economic consequences and shocking statistics have been investigated by thousands of scientists and contemplative minds. However, no phrase could be found as short, yet so comprehensive, as the valuable tradition of our Prophet, which in one sentence says it all. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the Prophet of Allah, he has said, "Avoid wine, which is the key of all evils." You know, when you look at those who consume alcohol, you're bound to conclude that this person, one way or the other, is going to be detrimental for the human society. We all feel that. Sometimes we express it, sometimes we don't, especially those living in the West. But we know deep down in our heart, through empirical evidence, that these people who consume alcohol, they are more dangerous for human societies than other human beings, generally speaking. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing, in the light of a tradition, a source of all evils. Prophet Muhammad has said that drinking alcohol, consuming wine, is one of the most important and prevalent source of evil in human society. You know, just take a moment out and go onto the internet and just search vices or dangers of consuming alcohol. You would see, look at the local newspaper that you have for your city. you know, wherever you may be living in the West, where alcohol and wine and other, you know, beer and other alcoholic beverages are easily found and they're not illegal to be consumed, just look at the local news. Even in places where it may be illegal and people are smuggling the alcohol in and consuming alcohol, look at what the aftermath of this consumption of alcohol is. I think for any sane and logical person, it is enough for him to be discouraged from consuming alcohol. Now, this is all in addition to what Islam has said. Islam has absolutely prohibited alcohol in any form and shape which is consumed to be intoxicated, right? This is in addition, we're looking at the aftermath and the effects of alcohol. Those effects and impacts on human society, on other innocent lives, on other human beings, enough in itself is enough for one to be convinced that consuming alcohol is something wrong and must be stopped. In Islamic lifestyle, consuming alcohol has no place whatsoever. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
Israeli settlers are committing violent daily attacks against Palestinians harvesting their olive trees for the season. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Zina At-Tahan, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Settler Attacks Wreak Havoc on Palestinians During Olive Harvest. Stay tuned for more. Israeli settlers are committing violent daily attacks against Palestinians harvesting their olive trees for the season. The attacks, which include beatings of farmers and destruction of trees, preceded the formal start of the olive harvest season on October 12th in the occupied West Bank, but intensified in the number over the past week. The most targeted areas have been in the northern occupied West Bank, around villages south of Nablus City and Salfit, according to local observers. Ghassan Douglas, who monitors settler violence in northern West Bank, told Al Jazeera they recorded 58 attacks since the start of the season, including 9 on the village of Burin, south of Nablus alone. It is evident that there is an increase in the attacks. We are 30% into the olive harvest season, and we have already had 58 attacks in north of the West Bank, said Douglas, describing the attacks as planned and not spontaneous. Harvesting olive trees is a key economic, familial, and social activity for many Palestinians who take days off work to tend to their lands or those of their relatives, neighbors, or friends. Between 80,000 to 100,000 families rely on olives and olive oil as primary or secondary sources of income. While settler attacks are a frequent near daily reality for Palestinian villages, the number and intensity of attacks increase during the olive harvest season, which runs until November, as settlers target families working on their lands. On October 12th, settlers uprooted 900 olive and apricot saplings and stole olive crops in the village of Sebastia, north of Nablus. A further 70 olive trees were destroyed in Masafer Yatta, south of Al-Khalil. In Avarta, east of Nablus, settlers chopped down dozens of olive trees on October 13th and sprayed them with chemicals. They also destroyed some 70 olive fruit and vegetable trees in Al-Tawani, south of Al-Khalil, and slashed tires and vandalized cars and walls in the village of Marda near Salfit. On October 14th, settlers cut down more than 80 olive trees in the village of Al-Mughayr, north of Ramallah. The next day, they attacked the Hamoud family in the village of Yusuf near Salfit with rocks, injuring four. The family and other residents were attacked again on October 16th. Settlers also beat residents of Burain near Nablus that day with batons and set olive groves ablaze, injuring at least 12 Palestinians. Douglas said while in previous years the attacks would begin a week after the start of the olive harvest, this year the attacks began early, which forced Palestinians to tend to their trees quicker than expected. Since the end of August 2021, settlers have injured at least 22 Palestinians and ruined at least 1,800 Palestinian-owned trees, including 900 trees in Sebastia and 650 in Jama'a, in Nablus and Al-Tayyib in Al-Khalil. Douglas pointed out that, in addition to the burning and cutting down of trees, the attacks included stealing olive crops, chasing down farmers and pushing them off their lands, as well as threatening them and drowning parts of their land with the sewage water. Douglas said, "The settlers and the army are chasing us down over our livelihoods, our income, our bread, our sustenance." Palestinians say Israeli settlers very often come with army protection and are many times armed, which rights groups have documented. At times, the settlers and the army work together. The strategic building of the settlements on hilltops in the West Bank makes it easy for settlers to descend onto the Palestinian villages and their lands below. Additionally, settlers enjoy what the United Nations has called institutional and systematic impunity, which allows them to continue committing attacks. The UN described the attacks as being ideologically motivated and primarily designed to take over land, but also to intimidate and terrorize Palestinians. According to the latest updates by the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, UNOCHA, settlers carried out 20 attacks between September 21st and October 4th, a noticeable increase with the start of the olive harvest. Between September 7th and 20th, there were 11 attacks, while 6 were recorded between August 24th and September 6th. The largest recent attack came on September 28. A large group of masked settlers descended on to the South Al-Khalil village of Al-Mufagra and attacked residents with stones, injuring 29 Palestinians, including a 3-year-old boy who suffered fractures to his skull and was hospitalized. Settlers also damaged 10 homes, 14 vehicles, several solar panels and water tanks, and killed 5 sheep, according to OCHA. In a statement on October 12th, the International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC, said its data showed that over a period of 1 year, in August 2021, more than 9,300 trees were destroyed in the West Bank and called for the protection of Palestinian farmers. The ICRC also said it has observed a seasonal peak in violence by Israeli settlers residing in certain settlements and outposts in the West Bank towards Palestinian farmers and their property in the period leading up to the olive harvest season as well as during the harvest season itself. Until October 4th, OCHA recorded a total of 365 attacks this year, including 101 attacks that resulted in Palestinian casualties and 264 that resulted in property damage. The numbers have already surpassed last year's, which ended with a total of 355 attacks, including 274 on property and 84 casualties. Douglas attributed the rise in settler attacks to the ongoing expansion of the Zionist regime's illegal settlements in the West Bank and encroachment onto Palestinian villages. He said, for example, in the past, the settlement of Yitzhar south of Nablus was facing the village of Burin. Now the settlement has expanded over to the nearby villages of Madama, Orif, Inbas, and Hawara. Similarly, the settlement of Itmar once stood opposite to the village of Awarta, south of Nablus, while now it has extended to Beit Forik and Agraba, he said. In the past, we would focus on the villages near the settlements, but now the entire West Bank is near settlements, said Douglas, explaining the more the settlements grow, the more lands come under threat. He said while he sees a persistence by the Palestinian people to confront the army and settlers and remain on their lands, the settler attacks are a form of pressure. Douglas said the settlers are only growing in numbers and this terrorism is only growing. The people will explode one day and the world will bear responsibility. If the Palestinian people lose hope, they will rise up and there is not one power in the world that will be able to deter them.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی است.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
November 25th, 2018. In a meeting with government officials of the Islamic Republic of Iran, ambassadors of Islamic countries and participants of the 32 Conference on Islamic Unity. Practicing Islamic unity will allow Muslims to overcome all the schemes of the enemies of Islam. You should strengthen the Islamic movement as much as you can. The way to the salvation of this region is strengthening Islamic awakening in the movement of Islamic resistance. This responsibility falls on all of the masses of the Muslims, in particular the ulama of Islam, intellectuals, writers, poets, scholars, artists, and political personalities. They are responsible for this. They are the addressee of the invitation of the Holy Prophet and of Islamic guidance. Today, the ground is prepared in the world of Islam. The ground is prepared in West Asia, in particular, for Islamic awakening. Everyone should help so that this awakening will yield results. Our advice to the rulers of Islamic countries is to return to the wilaya of Islam. They should place themselves under the wilaya of Allah. The wilaya of the US and Taghut will not work for them.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Today, some Muslim countries in our region unfortunately stand under the flag and wilaya of Taghut instead of the wilaya of Allah. Instead of following Islam and the light of the Quran, they follow the US, and the US is humiliating them on the basis of its arrogant nature. You have heard, as everyone has, that the prattling US president has likened the Saudi rulers to a dairy cow. This is humiliation. This is an insult. It is an insult to the people of the region and the people of that country. If the Saudis do not have a problem with being insulted, then to hell with it. They can enjoy being insulted. However, this is an insult to the people of the region and Muslim nations. Why should Islamic rulers follow the US in two criminal actions which have unfortunately damaged our region? One is the criminal action against the Palestinians and the important issue of Palestine, and another is the criminal action against Yemen. They should be sure that the victory belongs to the people of Palestine and the people of Yemen, and that the US and its cohorts will be defeated on this matter.
Of Jalali Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Winter is coming, and from the looks of things, it will be a long, harsh, and very cold one. But at the same time, the world is in the midst of an unprecedented energy crisis with dire economic, social, and political ramifications. Brent crude has surged to a five-year high of over $80 per barrel, while gas prices are up over 500% year on year. The International Energy Agency says the global energy crunch is expected to boost oil demand by about 500,000 barrels a day. Analysts say the energy crisis is rooted in soaring demand as the economic recovery from the coronavirus pandemic takes hold, and the production level has simply failed to keep up with demand. However, some immediate measures could easily resolve this crisis. One such fix would be the removal of US sanctions on Iran, which enjoys one of the largest hydrocarbon reserves in the world. The flow of Iranian oil into the global market, for example, would be vital in easing the crisis.
Until a couple of months ago, it was not very important for the world that Iran is under sanctions because supply exceeded demand. But the current trends in the global market may put pressure on consumer countries, Europeans and countries like India and China or U.S. allies to push Washington to lift sanctions.
Iran has repeatedly underlined its ability to swiftly increase its crude production to help alleviate the global shortage. Its oil minister recently said people in the United States and some European countries are paying the price for their leaders' unwise policies. Javad Oji stressed that Iran, on several occasions, displayed its goodwill to help stabilize the oil market and resolve the global energy crisis. But U.S. sanctions are standing in the way. People in Lebanon, who have been facing gasoline and diesel shortages and electricity blackouts, bear witness that ways are found where there is mutual will. Iran has recently been delivering shipments of fuel to energy-starved Lebanon, despite U.S. sanctions targeting both countries. That was achieved through the determination of both Iran and the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah. Iran had also earlier dispatched fuel shipments all the way to Venezuela. Now, as millions of people around the globe are bracing for a hard and long winter, it's worthwhile to ask how much of the ordeal could be averted through a similar international resolve.
Fear is growing in Indian-controlled Kashmir following a series of shooting incidents across the region that killed around a dozen civilians, including four non-local workers. The fear doubled among the non-local residents after police said non-locals should reach army camps and police stations. Dhananjit Kumar has been working in Kashmir for the last 12 years. Each year he stays here for 6 months and returns home with his hard-earned money. But this year, he's moving ahead of time.
My family back home is worried. They insisted upon my return. I have worked for so many years here, but I have never seen such chaos. The situation here has never been right, but we were never involved. This time, it's different.
Dhananjit Kumar and many like him are on the move, while many others have sought police protection till they manage a way out. Following the deadly October violence in Kashmir that resulted in more than 33 killings, which included 9 Indian Army personnel, 11 civilians, and 13 pro-freedom fighters in different incidents, the administration issued an alert across the war-weary Indian-administered Kashmir. Intelligence reports warn of attacks on power projects, emergency landing strips, and other government infrastructure. New Delhi has installed additional security forces across Kashmir after intelligence reports warned of more attacks.
We are doing our best to neutralize the terrorists who are behind the civilian killings. We have killed around 11 terrorists in October till now, and we'll do our best to ensure the safety and security of our people. It's not a security lapse. The targets were soft, and now we beefed up and more vigilant.
After India stripped Kashmir's autonomous status in August 2019, people of the region were promised development, prosperity, and greater opportunities. However, media reports suggest the situation in the region has slipped from bad to worse due to the absence of local political activities and implementation of rules and laws without taking people of Kashmir on board. Kashmir is a dispute between India and Pakistan since the partition of Indian subcontinent in 1947. The two have fought wars over the territory and claimed the region in full, but rule it in parts. The press space